Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is honored to have with us virtually Ashley Winstead, whose new book is The Boyfriend Candidate. The Poison Pen does have copies of Ashley's new book as well as her prior books, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put them in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. And now I would like to welcome Ashley Winstead.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for taking time to join us. My first question for authors, as a reader, I'm always fascinated by their journey to becoming published. So who was Ashley before you became a writer?
I love this question. So like most authors, I feel like we all kind of have, a lot of us have the same story. We were just consummate readers. Mm-hmm. And so just devouring everything I could get my hands on, like I was kind of cleaned the children's section of my local library out at one point. And so I was kind of climbing into my mom's shelves and reading her Danielle Steele and my dad's John Grisham and, you know, all the mass market paperbacks and just devouring everything I could. And the minute I realized that I could do that for a career, that was just, there was no question for me. I wanted to be a writer. I had this vision. I was going to live in New York City with a black cat in an apartment. And, you know, I probably saw that on a TV show somewhere, you know, and that was what I was going to do. And then everything was like full steam ahead with that. I went to college and majored in creative writing, loved it, flirted with poetry for a little while. And then I was all set to go, I thought, to MFA programs. Applied my senior year of college and got rejected from more than a dozen, every single one. And it was a very big kind of like wake-up call for me that, first of all, publishing and writing is hard. Just because I'd had, you know, smooth sailing in the academic portion of it as a student meant really nothing. And I did at that point, at the age of 22, with my fragile young ego, I did what you're not supposed to do as a writer. And I just took the rejection really seriously and personally. And so I didn't write again for 10 years because I assumed that meant like the world has said you are not actually a good writer. Figure out something else with your life. I'm like split 50-50 with regret that I lost all that writing time. But also, you know, I did other cool things. I worked in the TV industry, music industry. I got some life experiences. So it wasn't until I was 30 and I hit that sort of what felt like a milestone and a birthday, and I had just graduated from my PhD program in English, that I said to myself, you know what you're going to do? Simply because you love it and you're not ever going to show anyone, is you're just going to write a little book in secret. And so that's how I kind of got into it again, as I wrote my secret little book and gathered my courage, you know, and day by day. And the rest is kind of history. I was fortunate enough to get an agent with that first book. So I had a very different experience at 32, trying to, you know, get the world to accept my writing than I did at 22.
Was that book In My Knife I Hold, In My Dreams I Hold a Knife?
You know, funny enough, it wasn't. It was a book that will never see the light of day. Okay. It is a contemporary fantasy, a YA contemporary fantasy. I like laugh every time I say that because it's just like, who am I? I'm all over the place with my books. But I got me my agent, and my agent had so many edit notes for that book that, being like a procrastinator by nature, I looked at her edit letter and I thought, you know, it might just be easier to write a different book, like a whole new book, than go through and try to gut this one. And that's when I wrote In My Dreams I Hold a Knife, which turned out to be my debut. So.
Well, that brings us, you've published a couple books now. You have a new one out called The Boyfriend Candidate. It's your second rom-com. What can you tell us, our readers listening in, about this book?
Okay, so just a quick synopsis and then tell you why this book is so special to me. The Boyfriend Candidate is the second, as you mentioned, in a series. And so it follows my first rom-com, Fool Me Once, but they're also both standalone. So you don't have to read Fool Me Once to pick up The Boyfriend Candidate, but it follows a woman named Alexis Stone. She's right here on the cover, and she is your quintessential shy, bookish librarian who has gravitated always towards the world of storytelling and books, because she finds books and characters in books much easier to deal with than actual living people, which is probably an experience a lot of us writers and readers can identify with. But something else that defines Alexis is that she is kind of like the quintessential younger sister. So she has lived her life kind of in the shadow of her older sister, Lee Stone, who's bold and is a young female politician in Texas, which requires a lot of bravery. And Alexis, her whole life, has looked up to Lee, and seen Lee as this model of a kind of person that she could never be. And Lee is the definition of success to Alexis. And so, feeling so different from Lee, she's always felt like she's just not that kind of special person who deserves to be in the spotlight. And so when she meets a man named Logan Arthur at a, well, she doesn't know his name is Logan. She meets him out at a bar, and she is going to have her first one night stand with him. Unfortunately for Alexis, the hotel catches on fire from a freak lightning storm, and in their way rushing out, Alexis twists her ankle, Logan scoops her up in his arms, and they burst out of the hotel into the street with her kind of like in his arms. Very romance novel-esque scene there. All these cameras start flashing to her surprise. Logan takes off without another word. And Alexis is left to just think like, okay, once again, I wasn't enough to kind of like keep a person's attention. And then she finds out that these pictures have gone viral because he's Logan Arthur, the gubernatorial candidate, Texas Democratic gubernatorial candidate. And now he and his team want her to step into the spotlight and masquerade fake date as his kind of long-term girlfriend to kind of quell rumors. So the younger sister steps into the political sphere, and shenanigans ensue.
It's a wonderful book, and you talked a little bit about having that decade or so to gain life experience. I'm wondering if some of the things that you did made their way into The Boyfriend Candidate, because if I remember correctly, you worked as a communications director for a philanthropic group.
Yeah.
So did that, your experience writing policy and things like that, did that kind of give you insight? Talk about that, and are you related to Nora at all, the communications director?
Yes, I wish, because she would be an amazing person to be related to. Would just be like, please plan my entire life for me and tell me what to do. She'd do it. You're exactly right. For about 5 years after I got my PhD, and I was trying to figure out what to do with this degree in English, since I had decided I didn't want to teach and be a professor. And so I went into the philanthropy think tank world, really focused on politics. And I live here in Houston. And so this particular organization that I spent 5 years with is a kind of progressive policy organization. And so what they're trying to do is do a lot of science and research to figure out what the best policies are and then get them implemented. And so I was more on the part of getting them implemented and trying to persuade and convince politicians and voters that these were good ideas and we should care about, you know, people who were struggling in our society and so on and so forth. So the behind the scenes working in politics, like working in this kind of political world and going to Austin and going into the rooms, like the restaurants that have no windows, and you're kind of like sequestered into your, you know, the room where you're meeting with people and no one wants anyone to know who you're meeting with because it has to be a secret. And like that whole world and the absolute wildness of these large personalities I was sitting there and I couldn't, you know, NDAs and all sorts of stuff, couldn't actually talk about it. But I was like, maybe I could write fiction about this because truly, you know, some of this stuff is so strange and so hilarious and so terrible in some instances that it just needs to find its way out. And I honestly can't tell you why I was like, rom-com when I was thinking about that, other than I tend to have a kind of like slapstick leaning sense of humor, a little zany, a little goofy. And this world felt of politics felt really slapstick and goofy to me, or at least that's kind of how I was reading it. And so I imagined it as this like rom-com world. And maybe there was like a part of my brain that, you know, was we're beaten down at every turn trying to, you know, push progressive politics in Texas. And so I needed like to create the happy ending in fiction that I didn't have in real life. So yeah, taking direct experiences there.
But it was all filtered through a fictional background. So nothing you've written can be used against you by.
Exactly. And no one has come out of the woodwork to to wag their finger at me or like say, was this me? So far I'm safe.
You're safe. Alexis is a librarian, and I'm getting the impression that when she talks about how important libraries are to her, she's also channeling a little bit of you too in that.
Yes. So my dad was in the Navy growing up, and my mom was a homemaker, stay-at-home mom. And so really we were all focused on my dad's career. And we moved around every 2 years, kind of bounced from coast to coast, Virginia, California, Florida, so on. We would do these long road trips through Arizona was one of our favorite places to stop. And so I was a very, very shy child, much like Alexis. I took that very much from myself. Very shy child to the point where there's one year where I think the entirety of fifth grade, my only memory is my sneakers, the vision of my sneakers against the linoleum floor, because I'm pretty sure I just looked down for a full year. So shy. And libraries were my refuge. And there was one library in particular when we happened to live on base in Point Loma, California. There we had a library on base. So it was like this special library just for us. And I lived there. And that is the library whose children's section I pretty much cleaned out. And I was like, what else you got in here?
Rom-coms are equal parts when they're done right, romance and comedy. And you have a very deft hand with the comedy part. I love the little chapter headings that introduce, I guess that's what you call them, whatever.
Yeah.
Does that just come easy to you? Is comedy work for you?
Oh, thank you so much, first of all, for that compliment, because it is such hard work for me. Sometimes since I write both thrillers and romantic comedies and take the comedy part of the comedy very seriously, like I had a conversation with my agent about romantic comedies, and she was like, it needs, like, comedies, they just need to be funnier. So I want you to like amp this up. And I'm just like, I'm totally there with you. Anyway, so people ask me which one is easier for you to write, and hands down thrillers are easier for me to write. I think like I'm a drama queen at heart. And so that like dark, you know, emo sort of sensibility that lends itself well to thrillers is just my natural state. The comedy is much harder. And so with both Fool Me Once and The Boyfriend Candidate, these are books that are romances, of course, but they're also really about sister bonds and family bonds. And so I was lucky enough to have my sister living / trapped with me during the pandemic. And she was gracious enough to allow me to read her chapter by chapter both of these books as I wrote them. And so my process was I would write a chapter for both of these books, and have so much fun writing it, because I was imagining you know, to performing it later. And then around 5 or 6 p.m., we'd sit down on the couch and I would read it out loud kind of as a performance. And it helped me so much to figure out what jokes were landing, where I'd phrase something really awkwardly, what parts were funny that I didn't even realize. But, you know, just that whole, it was kind of like trying, a comedian trying out their like routine at a comedy club, kind of just working through my material and taking notes like, did not laugh, must revise, you know, that were a majority of the notes. So I really wanted it to be genuinely funny. And I think that that is the hardest thing to translate from one brain to paper to another brain. So anytime I hear that people thought it was funny, I'm like, oh, thank God.
Well, it's interesting when you mention the process of writing both books, because in a way, each chapter is like a scene in of itself that's perfect in its little kind of unique way. But when you put them all together, it's like a quilt. You see this whole bigger picture too. So that's a wonderful
I love that.
Side to your process.
I'm actually going to steal, that is how I think of, or especially my romantic comedies, but I actually kind of think of all my books that way. I'm going to steal that. I'll credit you in future interviews, but I'm going to steal that.
Let's talk about your writing process a little bit, because it may have changed, but at one point you said for you, when you were asked whether plot or characters are the initial starting point, you said characters only, and that your writing method holds the plot must emerge from character, that once you have a firm grasp on a character, especially the main character, what they want and fear and need, then you can start your plot. Does that still hold true?
100%. I don't think plots are interesting unless your reader understands what the events or the actions mean to your character. And so I always start with character, and I have to credit Lisa Cron, who's author of Story Genius, a craft book. And I've actually had, I talk about her so much that people are like, are you in a sponsorship relationship with her? I'm like, no, I just love her. And I just think that this craft book is brilliant, Story Genius. But it is really her argument. So, you know, got to credit her, where she says, you know, she has been a writing coach and has watched so many writers write really exciting plots for 300 pages and have books just not connect to readers and flop and, you know, just not have the success that the author expected, because there wasn't that strong enough connection between that focal character, your protagonist, the person who's the hero or heroine of your book, and all everything that's happening around them. So she argues that people actually read books for that experience that we all get, where we can project our consciousness and kind of like that mirror neuron connection, where we get to kind of hang out in someone's brain and watch them deal with things and kind of think about how we would do that ourselves. And she's, you know, she's a neuroscientist, so she makes a lot of really compelling arguments about why that's been really evolutionarily beneficial for humans. So I always start by going through her process. I've actually memorized it at this point, so I don't even need to consult her book anymore. I'm kind of just like, okay, we're going to start with like all the misbeliefs and things about my character. So I'll dive really deep into character work. And if I have a few central characters, I'll do it for them as well. So Logan in The Boyfriend Candidate got his, you know, whole character assessment. And so then I figure out exactly what I need to do to my characters to make them feel their worst and make them feel their best. And, you know, all of those things, like the thing that's going to gut them, the thing that's going to make them weep with happiness, like all those things. That's what your plot has to be. You kind of like sketched it out.
That's fascinating. Part of your writing process, I'm wondering, and this could just be me imagining it, but it must be almost like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of experience, because you're writing romantic comedies, you're writing dark suspense novels. Yep. People might think there's no kind of common thread between the two. But actually, you did say something that is kind of profound in its way. Romantic comedies are about beginnings, and suspense and thriller novels are about endings, and that's their bookends in a sense.
Yep. Yes. And I feel both like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That's very apt. But I also do feel that sense of continuity, and I've been working a little bit harder. One of the great things I found about being a writer versus being an academic in my previous life is that an academic, you have to be incredibly self-aware and be able to explain and analyze why it is you think certain things. And being a writer, that is a very helpful thing to be able to do as well, of course. But there are so many things in the world of being a writer where you can just rely on your instinct. And, you know, it's someone, I forget, I think it was maybe Amy Gentry, the suspense writer, Amy Gentry, who said, "My writing brain is a lot smarter than my plotting brain or my analyzing brain. Like, it knows to do things my other brains don't." And I found that to be so true. And so writing these books for a few years, I felt like instinctively that there was a connection and a continuity, but I couldn't, my other brains weren't smart enough to figure it out. But finally, I kind of realized that I am writing very similar characters, like women who are complicated and flawed and don't believe that they're worthy of love and think that like love is something you earn. And that's a thing that I tend to return to a lot in my work. But I'm writing my rom-coms, like you said, are these women kind of at the beginnings of healing relationships, promising relationships. They're making good choices from these places. And my thrillers are women who are meeting the ends and the consequences of the bad decisions they've made. So that's my little continuity. Though I had this experience talking to an editor on a phone call, and we were both trying to, you know, persuade each other to work with each other. You know, it's like one of those high stakes, like meet and greets. And she was a romance editor, and she
I don't know if we've lost Ashley. We're back again after a temporary pause. Ashley was talking about beginnings and endings and meeting an editor and trying to convince each other they wanted to work with one another.
Yes, and she was a wonderful, lovely romance editor. And she said, you know, I'm so fascinated by this two genre thing. Like, you have to be, I'm convinced, two people in there, like two people, multiple personalities. And I, you know, understood she was joking, but I think my delivery was a little too dry in my response. And I was like, yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. There's two people in here, and one writes the romance and one writes the thriller. And we had this moment where we kind of just stared at each other and smiled, and she's like trying really hard to figure out if she just stumbled into something. So now I just have to say, like, yes, there. It's the same brain, I swear. Just different.
It's the same voice in your books. You have the same characteristic. It's just the story you're telling is different in different
Thank
genres.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Let's talk a little bit about Ashley as a reader. Your journey through the reading life. Let's begin by having you talk a little bit, if you'd like, about what role Sweet Valley High books played.
This was, I think that's how I learned to binge books, like Sweet Valley High. And as a, you know, as an adult feminist in her 30s, I recognize how highly problematic these books are, you know, and the vision of femininity, white, like very, very slender, very traditionally beautiful, that these Wakefield twins were. Putting all of that problematic stuff aside, man, I have read every single one of those hundreds of books in that series. multiple times. And, you know, I credit Sweet Valley High with like helping to teach me at a young age that fast-paced books are great. Books can go in, you know, a lot of really weird and wacky and wild directions. And if you've got your reader hooked, they'll come with you. So yeah, that was a huge love of mine. And of course, reading Roxane Gay's essay as a graduate student, where she writes about her own love of Sweet Valley High. I think the essay is titled Once I Was Miss America. And it's just, if anyone listening hasn't read it, it's not too long. It's so fabulous. And she talks about not being represented by the Sweet Valley High books and what that meant to her as a young girl. But also just devouring them for the vision and kind of view of like American teenage life that they put forward. So I if you can't tell, a dream project of mine would be to like write for that series if it ever gets revamped or something like that. Yeah. I'm pretty obsessed.
It's interesting because I can see that kind of nurturing the romantic side of your writing career. And then you read Absolutely. Christopher Pike, who I remember from the 90s, and that's your suspense side.
And that's my suspense. And, you know, I had to hide my Christopher Pike books mm-hmm. from my mom because she picked one up and started reading it and was like, oh no, not for you. This is way too, you know, because I think they were YA, but they were pretty graphic for YA.
Yeah, they were definitely more than the Fear Street kind of books and things like
that. Yes. Yeah. But I absolutely loved them. So then it was, you know, the game of like, how many of these can I read in secret, you know, before my mom finds them. But you know what's so funny is, so I have this, you know, these are like amazing commercial fiction. And Sweet Valley especially is, you know, so attuned to what young female readers want to read. So I love these books. And then I going through at my schooling process and really wanting to get into a prestigious college because, you know, I wanted a good job and, you know, everything like that. I think I molded my literary taste around like the great American canon. I kind of like revamped my reading taste and would just read, you know, classics by older men. And so it completely reframed what I thought of as good books, good writing. And when I looked back at my honors thesis recently for in college, you know, the thing that got rejected by all the MFA programs, and it was a series of linked short stories, and every single one of the short stories starred a man. I hadn't written from a female perspective. I even had this one story I was writing as a college student about an older male professor who was having an affair with a young female college student. I wrote it from his perspective. And I just, I'm looking back at that and I'm like, wow, I've really kind of lost myself for a few years. And it took me a while to come full circle back to my Sweet Valley High roots and say to myself, you know, it's okay to write books centered on women, on young women, on things that young women like, and embrace romance and embrace drama and all these things. And I know I'm being highly reductive right now by like assigning these things, but just embracing what felt like my voice instead of trying to ventriloquize good writing. And that was once I kind of embraced that, like the pleasure of writing, the way I used to embrace the pleasure of reading, is when I started getting published and people started wanting to read my work again. So I try to give that advice to anyone who asks me for writing advice.
Now, you do have a PhD in American literature, is that correct?
Yes, I do.
You can answer this question or not, but I find it interesting. What is one book from the canon that, if you could, you would put in every reader's hands and say, you have to read this book?
Oh my God. Maybe The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood, which was not the Margaret Atwood book I taught the most, which was The Handmaid's Tale, which in these times is a very interesting book to be teaching. But it is a book about two sisters, and I think I'm obsessed with the book because it has so much to say about the choices that we make and the wildly different lives that we all lead because of these choices. But just from a craft perspective, it is like a holy grail book to me because somehow Margaret Atwood managed to weave all of these concentric circles of stories together. I guess the technical term is braided narrative. It's stories within stories within stories. And at some point as a reader, you lose track of who is telling the story that you're reading and whether it's the main, this fictional assassin or these two sisters who are at the heart of this novel. And she does it so brilliantly. And I would put that book in everyone's hands just because I think it's one of the most empathy generating stories I've ever read.
Now,
Yeah.
yeah. Here's the flip of that question.
Okay.
What is the one book you think no one should, from the canon, that no one should ever be forced to read in their lifetime?
Anything by Herman Melville. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I know all my early Americanists are going to be like, how dare you? Brilliant. And he did shape a lot of the publishing industry in early America. He was a good dude. He did good things. But the minute you put one of his books in my hand, I am out like a light. And I just don't think anyone should have to suffer through that.
Fair
Yeah,
enough.
lots of email.
What's on your summer reading list this year? Are there any books you'd like to share with readers out there?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So to me, summer means poolside reading. And so for that, I'm always going to turn to May Cobb in the thriller space. Absolutely love May Cobb's work. And so A Likable Woman, I just absolutely devoured. That's her book that just came out, I want to say a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. It's so good. Readers will recognize it by the sultry cover with the woman in the pool. It just tells you everything you need to know. And it was just a book that I couldn't put down as soon as I picked it up. In the rom-com space, I absolutely adore Ava Wilder's rom-coms. And she just came out with Will They or Won't They, which is her sophomore romance. She is so good at writing celebrity romance and just making it feel like both frothy and exciting and fun, but also it's got some real weight and substance. Her characters are always dealing with things, weight and substance. So I just love Ava's work. Tara Shelton Harris and her book, her debut,
Yeah,
One Summer
One
in
Summer in
Savannah.
Savannah, yeah.
Oh my God, it's just absolutely beautiful. That's another book I would try to put in as many people's hands as possible because I just think it's an absolutely powerful story. Of a woman who, if folks aren't listening, who don't know kind of the premise of this, it is about a woman who was assaulted, was raped, sexually assaulted, and had a child out of that experience, whom she loves and adores and is the light of her life. But obviously, she is carrying this wound of what happened to her. And she has to, because of like life reasons, she has to go back to her hometown, the place where this happened. And she ends up meeting the twin brother of the man who assaulted her. And they begin to form a relationship that is just very healing and raises a lot of questions about forgiveness. And so I just think Tara Shelton Harris is a brilliant writer. And so that debut is just like absolute
Such a
amazing.
powerful book, and I'm
Yes.
thinking, how on earth can anyone pull that off? Because how can you find it in yourself to forgive? But she does. She's an
She
amazing
does.
writer. It'll be interesting to see what she
Yep.
does.
And because I've had the privilege of speaking to her, I know that her next book is going to be just as, you know, book club discussion worthy and fraught. And so I'm really looking forward to just her career that she has ahead of her.
Before we run out of time, what's next for you as an author? I know you have another book coming that also has a library connection.
Yes. So it turns out when you write two books a year, it's really helpful to have one character with one profession that you can learn a lot about and then use in two different ways. No, I will actually confess that I did not plan that and has stepped back at some point and was like, okay. Let's see what I've done here. Yes. So this next book is my next thriller. It's called Midnight is the Darkest Hour. It is coming out on October 3rd. And it opens with a skull being pulled out of the swamp in a very, very small coastal town in Louisiana. And this town is Southern Baptist country. Everyone is very morally upright. There hasn't been a homicide, so they think, here for decades and decades. So no one knows who the skull belongs to or how it got there, except for our protagonist, Ruth Cornier, the preacher's daughter, the model of good femininity in town. And she believes she knows exactly whose it is and how it got there because she put it there. So that's coming out in the fall. And then I just actually announced that I'm moving into the romantic drama kind of upmarket book club fiction space. And so that's what I'm currently writing right now is a book called Future Saints, tentatively titled.
I think we call it relationship fiction in the library world.
Is that okay? Great.
Yeah.
I am looking for a better term for this.
It used to be women's fiction, but that was fraught with its own potential.
I refuse to use that term. Yeah.
Yeah, because there is no men's fiction. So why should we label
Thank
something?
Thank you. Yes, fiction? I know. Like, why are we sequestering this fiction that just happens to be female centered? Yes.
That's okay, relationship fiction. Yeah.
I love that. Another thing I'm taking and stealing from you.
We'll have to give credit to the American Library Association.
Okay.
So before we also have to conclude, how can readers learn more about your books? Are you a devotee of a particular social media platform?
I am. Yes, I am always too often on Instagram. So you can find me at Ashley Winstead Books is my handle there. And ashleywinstead.com is my website. And I'm also on Twitter, but less frequently these days, or X or whatever it's called now. Yeah. But find me on Instagram.
Great. I will have to look you up. I'm sure those tuning in will find out more about you. We've been very fortunate at the Poison Pen to have virtually with us Ashley Winstead, whose new book is The Boyfriend Candidate, with a new book coming in October. It's not too early to reserve a copy. We do have it on order at the Poison Pen. I'd like to thank Ashley for taking time to be with us and for everyone tuning in to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen bookstore.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you all for listening and watching.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.